All right. Well, good morning. Can you hear me in the back of the room? Okay. We're in good shape. Thank you, everybody. So I'm going to talk about iodine status in the United States. We'll talk a little bit about the iodized salt that's as one of the issues. So just kind of a caveat that's I work with CDC. I'm a full-time professor at Emory, but I do some work with CDC. But I just want to mention that this doesn't represent the official views of the Centers for Disease Control or any of the organizations that I'm affiliated with. So what I wanted to talk about is kind of focus on three issues about iodine status of the U.S. population. A little bit historical, what's going on in the U.S. 100 years ago, recent and current status of iodine in the U.S., and then things related to where do we get our iodine in terms from our diet and other exposures. So just these are questions. Just make a mental note to yourself. These are the kind of questions I'm going to kind of address. But first of all, just ask yourself, are there any groups, and this is all just specifically to the United States, are there any groups who may be iodine deficient in the U.S.? What are the major dietary sources of iodine in the United States? Is all or most table salt iodized? How much salt that we consume, how much is from table salt? And then is the salt used in the food industry iodized? And have you ever heard if there's recommendations about for pregnant women or women planning to become pregnant on using a multivitamin containing iodine? And finally, do multivitamins contain iodine? So, those are the questions. I'm going to address all these. We'll see. We'll test your knowledge later. But let's just kind of briefly just talk about iodine deficiency in the U.S. And historically, it was known there was a wide area of the U.S. The shaded area here is called the goiter belt. These were areas you could just walk around and you would see people with large thyroids, visible thyroids, just due to inadequate dietary iodine. And that's not to say that the iodine deficiency wasn't in other areas of the U.S. This is the severe areas. And so you could, in these areas, goiter and children, 26% to 70%. And a lot of this came from looking at World War II recruits and that the uniforms had to have a certain collar length and that they had a very width and that the goiters were so large they couldn't wear the uniform, so there's a lot of exclusions. That was one issue. So finally, it came around, as already mentioned by Elizabeth, that 1924, it was found that, well, prior in the early 20s, that giving iodine, and actually the Chinese knew hundreds of years ago that iodine seems to, eating seaweed was good for reducing goiters, and some seaweed has a lot of iodine. So this concept that iodine has something to do with these goiters, and it was found that adding a little bit of iodine to salt could have an effect on reducing these goiters. So in 1924, it was voluntary, and it pretty much says eliminated the goiter belt, but pretty much made that the U.S. is pretty iodine sufficient. Whether that was all due to salt is another issue, but it dramatically improved things. So how do we assess the iodine status in the U.S.? So primarily, the primary source of data is from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Surveys. That's run through the National Center for Health Statistics, CDC. And I'm listing here the NHANES surveys that have performed iodine. So the NHANES 1 in the early 70s. NHANES 2 did not do urinary iodine, so I left that in red. So we don't have information from that NHANES. NHANES 3 in the late 80s, early 90s. And then the NCHS decided that we're just going to do NHANES all the time. So it's called continuous NHANES, starting their two-year increments, and so starting in 2001, 2002, and so on. So all these, we do have urinary iodine information. Elizabeth was talking about how do we assess dietary intake, direct assessment of how much iodine people consume, and we look at, well, how much is coming out in the urine. So from NHANES, there is a urine spot test. Specimens, a spot, some people like mentioned that 24-hour collection would be better, but it's hard to do that in cross-sectional surveys, although NHANES is probably going to do that. But even 24 hours just this assessment of recent iodine intake, and you need many of those to get usual intake, so it's not really feasible. And NHANES, if they're 6 years of age or older, they test for iodine. And continuous NHANES, they usually just do one-third of the urine specimens are tested for urinary iodine. And on some of the NHANES, they oversampled subgroups, specifically pregnant women. So just think, I'm going to present the information about urinary iodine concentration. But I just wanted to mention, just going back to what Elizabeth was talking about, who's the most kind of susceptible to having negative effects of iodine deficiency? And number one is developing fetus, because the damage done during fetal development is permanent loss. And so in order to protect the fetus, we really have to make sure pregnant women are protected. So I'm going to first talk about the urinary iodine in pregnant women in the U.S. The second group, probably in terms of, and these are kind of my feeling, who are the most important target groups to protect, would be women of childbearing age, because they may become pregnant, and then infants and young children can also suffer from iodine insufficiency, and then men can also suffer from the effects of iodine deficiency. So what I'm going to do is present from the NHANES, the median urinary iodine for the pregnant women, not pregnant women, and school children. I'm not going to present for the men. They're okay. There's no problems in that group. They're iodine sufficient in the U.S. So here we're looking at pregnant women. Now, the bar goes, top of the bar is the median. We have confidence limits around each of those median values. And the lower part is, it says insufficient iodine intake. If the bar is in that lower area, that would be considered the median values in that area. According to the World Health Organization, they have insufficient iodine intake in general. And between the two dash is adequate, and above the top one is above requirement intake. And this one consistent thing has been found that NHANES 1, we had a lot of iodine in our diet. So NHANES 1 on the far left is very high. We get to NHANES 3. This is pregnant women. Now they fall below the cutoff. They're in that insufficient iodine intake range. And then we get to the continuous NHANES. It's kind of bounced around, but it's right around the adequate and insufficient range. So a little bit of seems an issue about iodine sufficiency in the United States. So just to summarize this, in the past 25 years, all the NHANES lower confidence limits, we look at the lower confidence limits from NHANES 3 and onwards for the last 25 years, they've all been below into the insufficient range, so we're not sure. And then if you look at the median value, four out of the past six surveys show that insufficient iodine intake. And if we looked at the continuous NHANES, the last three surveys for pregnant women, they are all three, the medians are in the insufficient range. So this is an area of concern. Now, if we look at the not pregnant women, 15 to 44 years of age, again, NHANES 1, we had lots of iodine in the urine, and then from NHANES 3 on, it's dropped. But at least in the not pregnant women, they've all been within that adequate iodine range. So things seem to be doing pretty well for the not pregnant women. Now remember, the ranges differ between pregnant and not pregnant. Pregnant women have a higher range than the not pregnant women. So I would say in general, past 25 years, all NHANES median UIC, urinary iodine concentrations, and the lower confidence limits in not pregnant women were all in the adequate iodine intake range, so it seems to be pretty good. Then we look at school-aged children, 6 to 11 years of age. Again, on the far left, NHANES 1 in the early 70s, and this time we're in the excessive iodine intake. And then from NHANES 3 and on, it's been pretty much in the above requirement iodine intake range. So our school-aged children get lots of iodine. So just the past 25 years, all the NHANES for the urinary iodine concentration for school-aged children are in the adequate or above adequate requirement range. Now, some people might be concerned that, well, they're in the above requirement iodine range, and there's actually some evidence to suggest that maybe that's not a health issue of being in that range. It doesn't seem to be any different from what's the adequate iodine intake range, but that's still subject to a little bit further investigation. So, that's talking about the urinary iodine. So we can see that seems like pregnant women may have some deficiency and not the not pregnant and school-aged children are okay, and I didn't show the men, but they were okay. But where do we get iodine in our diet? And so I'll talk about salt, dairy, bread and grains, multivitamins, and medical exposures. Elizabeth showed that we do have exposures to betadine, there could be contrast media. It's used quite a bit in medical, but I won't talk about it. But there are other sources, ways in which people are exposed to iodine. So, table salt in the U.S., is it iodized? And first of all, the iodization in the U.S. of salt is voluntary. No one has to do it. It's just kind of, they can do it if they want. We use a certificate that's potassium iodide, 60 to 100 parts per million potassium iodide. That converts to about 47 to 74 parts per million iodine. Most of the world uses potassium iodate. It's a little bit better. It's a little more stable. The percentage of table salt iodized in the U.S. is really unknown. There's just some guesses. And it's estimated that, and I'm talking about table salt, I'm talking about if you go to the grocery store and you buy a table salt that's sitting on the shelf, probably around about 50 to 70% of that in the U.S. is iodized. But again, we don't know with any certainty. Most countries do have salt iodization programs. You usually go to households and actually do measure what proportion of households are using iodized salt. So, how about the food industry? Do they use iodized salt? And to our knowledge, little if any salt used in the food industry is iodized. So let's just look into this issue about salt. We can think about all the salt that people consume. About 77%, that large part of the pie chart, is from restaurants, processed foods. So a little more than 3/4 of all the salt that we consume is food prepared by someone else. And about 11% of the salt that's consumed comes from table salt. And that's either adding it to the food at the table or during cooking. So about 11%. So all that salt that we purchase from the grocery store, it actually has very small part of the salt that's consumed in our diet. And there's 12% naturally occurring. Now, an issue about use of table salt, and NHANES does ask this question. One issue is that if you women of reproductive age, 50% of women report that they rarely or never use table salt. So in terms of adding salt at the table, I mean, it's just not done that often for certain groups, especially women of childbearing age. So what are the major dietary sources? We talked about there is salt. It's probably one source. And, you know, NHANES does do 24-hour dietary assessments when they do the surveys. This is a problem, though, because iodine is not in the U.S. food composition table. So even though we have dietary information from studies, we don't have measures of how much iodine is in the foods. So that's kind of rules out NHANES for that purpose. But luckily, there is the total diet study, which the FDA runs. And it began in 1961, and they are really trying to look for chemical contaminants and pesticides and foods, but they also measure certain minerals and other things, including iodine, which is great for the iodine world, because otherwise we'd have no idea what's going on in the U.S. And they have a food basket, and they try to pick a few foods to kind of represent different types of foods. It's not a large sample size, but 3 locations and 4 regions. So the sample sizes, we're talking about pretty small numbers, but over a number of years, these numbers, number of foods tested, is helpful. So they do not assess for any use of added salt in the foods or supplements. What I talk about, they just don't collect information on use of table salt or supplements. And they only do very specific age and sex groups. So let's look at some of the total diet study information. So this is the table. The foods are on the left. You can see the target groups across the top, children 2 years of age, children 6 years of age, women 25 to 30 years of age, men 25 to 30. And the numbers in the middle of the table represent what proportion of all the iodine that's consumed comes from that food item. So what jumps out is dairy is the number one thing. So who would have thought that there's lots of iodine in dairy? But you can see that for most of the groups, that's the primary source of iodine in our diets in the U.S. And then the second one comes from grain products. So those are the top two, dairy and grain. Again, the total diet study doesn't have anything about iodized salt, so we can't use the total diet survey for that information. So then the question goes, why do we have all this iodine in dairy products? And then it works out that, number one, just like humans, cattle, they need salt. It's good for their health, so they tend to add iodine as part of the feed. But then also you have the whole issue about milking the cows, so they have to, for the teats, they usually use iodine to clean the teat before the milking equipment's added. After the suction cups pop off the teat, they use another long lasting iodine on the teat. And then they have all the plumbing, tubes, and everything else that every time they get done milking the cows, they have to clean the whole system out. And so iodine may or may not be one of the chemicals used to disinfect the plumbing system. So that's the main reason. This is not for planned purposes for dealing with iodine deficiency or anything else. This is just the way the companies, the dairy companies work. So is there a relationship between dairy consumption and urinary iodine concentration? And so using NHANES, yes, this just shows we've done this for school-age children. We've done this for, this is the not pregnant women. We've done it for pregnant women. But in general, the more someone consumes in terms of dairy products, the higher the urinary iodine. The far left, in this case, although this is, happens to be not pregnant women, those who consume no dairy, their urinary iodine is just barely above the cutoff or into the sufficient range or adequate range. A little bit of dairy, not much, but the more they consume to the, not to the very end, the total 30, but the one next to it, consuming more than 357 grams, their urinary iodine is now up about 153. So that's the biggest driving force. And actually, we've done linear regression, looking at this, controlling for everything, other things, and dairy is the number one predictor of urinary iodine status. Now, there's also this issue about the grains, and some of it boils down to breads that the way different bakers might, things that they use when they make bread. And one thing is called, they use conditioners. And some of these conditioners may contain iodate. Not all, but some may have iodate. And iodate conditioners could be added to bread to promote freshness and prolong shelf life. But also conditioners also help in the bread rising to be moist and soft. If you don't use conditioners, it may be denser. If you use conditioners, it just makes it a little bit lighter. So Elizabeth, the previous speaker, did a study in Boston, and they looked at bread samples, and some of them had huge amounts of iodine, 300 micrograms per slice. That's double the usual recommended dose for adults. And if you make a sandwich of two slices, now you have quite a bit of iodine. That was just some. That was just some bakeries that were probably using iodate conditioners. Other brands of bread had very low levels of iodine, so it's a very hit or miss kind of thing. Okay, so that's the dietary information. So how about multivitamins? Well, maybe multivitamins might be an issue, something to be dealt with. So did you know that there are recommendations that every pregnant woman and women planning to become pregnant in the U.S., that they should have a daily supplement? I mean, did you know that this was out there? And I ask people, no one seems to really know. And you can ask obstetricians and others, and it's kind of an unknown thing. 2006, the American Thyroid Association, looking at NHANES and seeing what's going on with the urinary iodine levels in women, they recommended that all women, pregnant women take a daily multivitamin that contains iodine. In 2011, the American Thyroid Association added to women who are planning on becoming pregnant that they should take a multivitamin containing iodine. And over time, it's been more and more organizations kind of go along with this. American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, Endocrine Society, Neurobehavioral, Teratology Society. So there are more and more groups that see that this is an important issue. Pregnant women in the U.S. are maybe have inadequate iodine intake, and we need to deal with it to prevent some of the negative consequences of iodine deficiency. Well, the question is, what proportion of women take a daily multivitamin? And if they take the multivitamin, does it really contain iodine or not? So this is tables looking at the, first of all, do women use a multivitamin? Now, this is kind of a relaxed kind of definition, any multivitamin in the last 30 days. And when I say multivitamin, it may just be the regular multivitamin you buy at the store, or it could be a what's called a prenatal vitamin, which is really just a multivitamin for prenatal purposes. But you can see, not pregnant women, about 43% used a multivitamin last 30 days. Pregnant women, about 77%, and lactating women, about 67.8%. Now, we also looked at, in the NHANES, we can see what was actually in that supplement, and we found that of the not pregnant women, what proportion took a multivitamin that contained iodine? It was only 20%. What that really shows is that about only half of the multivitamins that you purchase at the store actually contain iodine. And if you looked at in pregnant women, although pregnant women taking a multivitamin containing iodine is about 20%. And that kind of showed that it's only about 25% or so of the multivitamins that pregnant women use contain iodine. And for lactating women, again, of the multivitamins they use, only about 20-some percent of those actually contained iodine. So we have an issue that, first of all, what proportion use multivitamins? That's one issue. But then, does the multivitamin even contain iodine? And the information shows that most multivitamins do not contain iodine, and especially true for pregnant and lactating women. So these are the percentages that of the multivitamins containing iodine. Okay, so let me just summarize. Just thinking about iodine status in the U.S., maybe you walked in here thinking there was no problem, but there seems to be some issues that we need to resolve. Number one, most groups in the U.S., they do have adequate or above requirement iodine intake. That's great. The big exception is the group that's kind of most vulnerable to developing fetuses, that pregnant women have an iodine status that may not be adequate, and we may need to consider that. Now, I don't know. We don't know anything about the status of children under 6 years of age in the U.S. It's unknown. Iodine excess does not appear to be a public health problem. The most dietary iodine is completely unplanned from dairy and some bread products. Most multivitamins do not contain iodine, especially for those used by pregnant and lactating women. So who are the groups at risk of being iodine deficient in the U.S.? Well, and it may be a combination of these things. It may not just be one, but pregnant women, which we showed. Those who consume little or no dairy products. I mean, there are vegans or individuals who are lactose intolerant that they really consume very little iodine. Excuse me, very little dairy products, which means their dairy iodine intake will be low. Consume little or no commercial bread products. Do not use a multivitamin containing iodine. Do not use table salt. Use non-iodized salt or use salt substitutes. And one thing I didn't show is in the not pregnant women, 15 to 44 years of age, that the iodine intake drops dramatically with age. And when you're around in the early 40s, it's even the not pregnant women, they're right on the cusp of being iodine deficient. And there are occasional case reports that come up in the literature about finding individuals in the U.S. who are iodine deficient. They tend to be adult women, don't consume dairy products, and don't use a multivitamin with iodine. So what can we do about this in the short term? Well, in the short term, I think the daily vitamin containing iodine for pregnant women, lactating, those likely to become pregnant is an option. But there's work needs to be done to work with the multivitamin producers to ensure that iodine is used in the product and that it's the correct type of iodine at the right level. And there is work being done on that. The American Thyroid Association, the Centers for Disease Control, has endorsed that multivitamins should contain iodine. But there are limitations. First of all, to start in pregnancy, you really need to start the supplementation early, iodine supplementation, not as early as folic acid supplementation. Folic acid, usually you want sufficient 3 months prior to pregnancy, and iodine, they have a little bit more time, but it's really critical that that first trimester that woman has adequate iodine intake. And unfortunately, 50% of pregnancies, women don't realize it's not unplanned, and by the time they see a physician and they start taking a multivitamin, they may have already missed the boat to prevent some of the effects that can be caused by iodine deficiency. And then again, not all women will use an iodine deficient supplement. And usually those who don't use supplements tend to be poor, tend to be not married, and have a number of other kind of poor health settings, smoke cigarettes and other issues. So what's possible solutions? And I'm just going to point out one. This is just one other country. I don't know if we could do this in the U.S., but the Swiss model. What they do is 90% of their table salt's iodized, and that 70% of the salt used in the food industry is iodized. And it's all voluntary. They just ask the companies, will you please use iodized salt, iodize a certain level. And they do a fairly careful monitoring, just like we do in Haines. They carefully monitor the urinary iodine status of the population. And if they think that they need more iodine, they just bump up the amount of iodine that's needed in the salt. Currently, it's about 20 to 30 parts per million iodine at the production of salt. Another possibility is we'll have a presentation by the next presenter. We'll talk about New Zealand. Their approach is dealing with using bread that contains iodine. I'll let her present that information. So I just want to give a special thanks to Dr. Christine Swanson. She's with the NIH, the Office of Dietary Supplements. She's the one who organized this, and that in NIH, she's really trying to promote the deal with the issue of iodine. It's kind of been, no one's really thought about too much for a few decades. Now it seems to be a problem, and she's kind of been a leader at NIH. I have my CDC collaborators, a lot of these studies that I've done, I presented with Drs. Correa, Perrine, Larry Gremmestron, Rafael Flores, Mary Sudula, Kathleen Caldwell, and also Dr. Elizabeth Pierce and I have worked on a number of publications looking at the iodine status in the U.S. So thank you. So we have any questions? Yes. 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 Oh, you. Okay, yes, yes. Could you use a microphone, please? In Cameroon, they actually have a pretty, really proactive, pretty good system for iodizing salt. That's the problem when you go to the far north. Nigeria is doing much better. In the past, Nigeria had some problems. Whenever you're dealing with iodized salt, you're concerned with salt coming from surrounding countries across that may not be actively iodizing salt coming into the country. So, you know, the ideal thing is just to make sure that all the foods, that preparation, and you know, I think what happened that iodized salt works pretty well, just the table salt works pretty well when most people, the food's made at home, it's consumed, but, you know, in industrialized countries are, like I showed before, only 11% of the salt that we consume comes from table salts, mostly pre-processed foods, restaurant foods. And that situation, and many countries have done this, they say that all salts, and actually the goal by WHO, UNICEF, and ICC, IDD was that all salt for human consumption should be iodized. Table salt, salt used in food production. And I think if that's done, then I think you're covered. I'm not sure what Cameroon does in terms of processed foods. I'm not sure how much processed foods. But even, you know, you go into even very poor urban slums, people are eating potato chips, salty kind of foods. And if they're not using iodized salt, then they're not, it's a missed opportunity. Oh, yeah. Or some sort of fried food, salty bagged foods that should, even in the very poor people areas, a lot of times they will buy these prepackaged foods for kids and stuff. So I would think I think iodized salt is probably any food that's produced and consumed by the children, then I would think that should be adequate. And usually they say like 20, 30 parts per million internationally.
And if it's not, because
Yeah. Yeah. I would say if there's foods being produced at the school for school children, if that's iodized, then I think that would be I would think it should be sufficient. But there's also, you can most countries do national surveys. They go to households, they assess what proportion of household salt's iodized. You can use a simple test, a little dropper, and pour it onto the salt. And if it turns blue, it shows that there's iodine there. It's not a perfect test, but it works pretty good. And so one issue is just making sure, is this salt that most people tend to have in their households, is it iodized or not, yes or no? And that's good information. And sometimes demographic health surveys do that, UNICEF, the multiple indicator cluster surveys, MIX, they do that testing. And Cameroon usually comes out pretty high, but I know in the northern area there's been a problem. If you're near Douala and stuff where some of the salt comes in, that's usually pretty good. Yeah. Yes. Well, you're always concerned about people consuming too much iodine. That has negative health effects. And I think for the usual diet person, no, that's not a problem. But some people who may purposely take supplements of very high levels of iodine, or they may, there are some foods that could be high in iodine, like certain seaweeds. But usually in the U.S., in terms of if you look at the average U.S. consumption, that we just don't eat that much seaweed, so it's not an issue. But there are, there may be a very tiny percent of the people that maybe something that they do does have very high iodine intake, and that can be, harmful. But by and large, we don't see it. And we looked at any of the large groups by age, by gender, and other things. We don't see any groups today that have Yeah. Well, you can see from NHANES 1 to the more recent years, it's been a huge drop-off. So NHANES 1, that was an issue, and they were going around actually telling the dairy industry and others to cut back on their use of iodine because they're concerned about iodine excess. But today, we don't have as a population level, not an excess issue. Yes? Where iodine deficiency, the most severe deficiency occurs, tends to be in mountainous areas, just over thousands and thousands of years through rainfall and other things, the iodine gets leached from the soil, and so you tend to see iodine deficiency. And people, here we have an agricultural population. You ate the foods grown in the surrounding area. If the soils were deficient, the people were deficient. And so some soils are more likely to be deficient than others, mountainous ranges and floodplains. And so a lot of the iodine ends up going into the oceans. And so I think that's what you saw, is the mountainous areas, the Appalachian, the Rocky Mountains, and some of the other areas, maybe due to glaciation and other things across the U.S.-Canadian border, those soils just have low iodine. And also sometimes the iodine levels in groundwater can be high or low. Generally it tends to be low, but occasionally you come across areas that groundwater iodine can be very high. There's some areas in China that the groundwater just has very high iodine levels. In that population, they have huge intakes of iodine. But those are very rare events. But I think in the U.S., you can see that all the Gorder Belt was all in pretty much the mountainous areas. And now we get foods from around the world, and you think it should be less of an issue that some of the foods may be still grown in iodine deficient areas like Michigan. And I went to the University of Michigan. You can look at the medical class in the early 20s, and about half of them have these huge goiters. You could just see in their photograph. So I think it's just a deficiency issue of the soils, and that they consume the foods in that area. And the animals consuming those foods in that area are also deficient, and they'll have low iodine in their meat and in their milk.